The serve, sliced, backhand return. Rafa with a backhand volley, and it's over. Game, set, and match. His third U.S. Open Men's Singles Championship.
Sloan from deep beyond the baseline plays a backhand. Keys a forehand. Sloan just hammering away. Now steps into a forehand. It hangs over. Forehand netted by Keys, and Sloan Stephens is the 2017 U.S. Open champion. A warm hug at the net between the two friends.
Here comes a big smile with Sloan. She can't believe it.
Welcome to episode 20 of Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. We're edging closer to the U.S. Open itself, set to start August 27th at the Billie Jean King National Tennis Center in Flushing Meadows. Before that, we've got some top-level tennis to be played this week on the U.S. Open Series at the Western and Southern Open just outside Cincinnati in Mason, Ohio. Hey everyone, I'm Nick McCarville, actually in Mason, Ohio this week with you here on Courtside, and we've been celebrating on this podcast all year long, 50 years of the U.S. Open, 50 years of open-era tennis, and we're going to do so again this week. Here's how this episode is going to go. We're going to wrap up all the action from the Rogers Cup in both Montreal and Toronto from last week, and then preview this week's action to come here in Cincinnati. With us for those respective discussions is New York Times contributor and freelance journalist Ben Rothenberg. Then a couple weeks ago, I spoke with British number one Kyle Edmund about his rise in men's tennis that has coincided, coincidentally, with the absence of former U.S. Open winner and multi-slam champ Andy Murray. What are expectations for Kyle at the U.S. Open, where he has performed so well in the past, and how is it being the number one Brit with a nation that loves the big headlines so much? First, let's wrap Canada, and our title winners last week were familiar names. The two world number ones, both Rafael Nadal and Simona Halep, hoisted trophies up north, and with their wins, their stocks rise for what would be a first U.S. Open victory for the Romanian. Meanwhile, a title defense for Rafa, who is looking for his fourth win inside Arthur Ashe Stadium in a few weeks' time. Before we get to Ben, I know the start date on your U.S. Open calendar says August 27th, but this year, once again, Fan Week kicks off a week early. It starts Tuesday, that's this coming Tuesday, August 21st, and runs through the 26th. Come out to watch the qualifying tournament to see the top stars practicing up close and personal, and check out the brand new Louis Armstrong Stadium. It is really a cool week to feel the energy building up at the National Tennis Center, and you can do so during Fan Week. Come out and check it out. Okay, let's go ahead and get to our chat. This is Monday night in Cincinnati, just last night for me in this recording with Ben Rothenberg. We're standing on the press balcony, which actually kind of overlooks the backside of the Western and Southern Open, and Ben and I can both see the $25 million South Building, which actually looks absolutely incredible. But it's Monday evening. If you're listening to this, we're just into the week of Cincinnati tennis. I want to ask you first off, How do you chase stories? Because as a writer, obviously before the U.S. Open, the New York Times has big buildup. Yeah. You're a freelancer. You're here trying to get as much as you can, I would think, from this week of tennis.
Yeah, well, that's the idea. It usually works out pretty well. This is a great tournament just about every year. All the big players come here, are in U.S. Open frame of mind, so they're happy to answer U.S. Open questions, happy to engage on that, and the finish line is in sight for them on this. I mean, they put in a lot of work over the last few weeks on the hard courts, getting acclimated to the U.S. and to the conditions, what they'll be like in New York, and this tournament replicates the conditions pretty well compared to a lot of other slam warm-ups. I think it's one of the better ones that we have in the calendar. Yeah. So I think that it's pretty easy to come here and hopefully have some outside-the-box ideas to work on, some features, and just also kind of keep track of who's trending up, who's struggling, and sort of a bit of the, you know, odds making, for lack of a better term, going into the U.S. Open and seeing who's rising, who's falling, and you can get a pretty good temperature of how the U.S. Open's going to go in Cincinnati.
Well, and I feel like this year we've got a lot of different storylines sort of at our fingertips. Serena Williams continuing to make her comeback, obviously Ben making the final at Wimbledon. Andy Murray did lose in the first round here, but I would think that he's taking some positives from his summer back in D.C., won a few matches. But what are some of the storylines top level that you see overall? We saw Roger Federer pull out of Toronto, yeah. and that was, I think, a lesson learned from last year. He hurt his back in Montreal, did not play here, and then didn't necessarily do as well as he maybe wanted or hoped at the U.S. Open.
Yeah, so men first, I guess Rafa obviously winning the Toronto Masters title is a big positive step for him. He's the only one of the big four who's won a title in this on this hard court. It's a very short part of the hard court season already right now. But, you know, he won the U.S. Open last year through a pretty broken draw, it has to be said. He didn't have to play a lot of the top players in that tournament. So he's going in as defending champion, but maybe with almost something to prove in a weird sense, even though he is number one, you know, he's defending champion. He is almost certainly going to get a harder path this year, with more players probably being healthy, we hope, at this time of year. Because last year, I think, Djokovic was out, Federer was struggling. So this year, the field looks in better shape, and hopefully it turns into a good tournament for him. But he's looked great, and he played very convincingly in Canada and looks very sharp. We see some of the new guys coming up, too. I mean, that's the other thing. The Big Four is doing well always, but Washington had this all four next-gen guys, as ATP calls them, in the semifinals, which is a pretty incredible moment, showing that these guys from these 21 and under group are picking up the slack and are proving to be the kind of next challengers to the guys who are over 30. It's interesting. It's almost sort of like a generation almost got skipped in tennis, the way it's worked out on the men's side, which is strange, and I'm still trying to figure out exactly what happened to yeah. those guys born in that 9-year stretch.
Right.
But it's a lot of promise, and the amount of excitement that was generated in Toronto by Stefanos Tsitsipas was incredible. He's a very positive addition to the sport. He's very charismatic. He's brought a lot of Greek fans into the Toronto Stadium, so that was great to see the passion. You always love seeing different diasporas get clued into tennis when they have someone to root for, and you saw that with Djokovic, certainly. You saw that with Simona Halep on the women's side, bringing Romanians everywhere. So it's just cool to see, and I think it's a lot of really positive developments for the landscape of the men's game this month.
Yeah, and if we go over to the women's side, you mentioned Simona. Serena Williams actually just minutes ago won her match against Daria Gavrilova here in Cincinnati. She had sort of that exclamation point and question mark after loss to Johanna Konta, winning just one game in San Jose a few weeks ago. She then came out publicly and talked about her struggles as a mom, where she is with her personal life, where she is with, you know, a lot of, I think, the postpartum stress. But she looked really good tonight, and she will have so much of the spotlight on her coming into New York.
Absolutely. And look, I mean, players, especially later in their careers, I've heard everyone talk about this, from Andre Agassi to Chris Evert, you have more out-of-nowhere bad days later in your career. And that's sort of what the San Jose day was. A lot of things are going on in, you know, for her on-court, off-court there. And it was the most lopsided match of her career, loss of her career, winning only one game. So it is worth sort of taking a step back and be like, huh, especially coming right after a Wimbledon final. It's not what you expect, but contemplated incredibly well in that match, it has to be said. It sort of made the scoreline, you know, it wasn't just Serena going out there. It looks like the scoreline's so shocking that you first look at it and be like, wow, what was wrong with Serena? But really, Konta played pretty incredible tennis. And if it was like 3-3, people would have given Konta a lot more credit in a strange way. So I think that was something Serena clearly bounced back from. She's always gotten better after losses, and she learns from them a lot. And she's in good shape here. I mean, she still is the player to beat in tennis, in women's tennis, and that will always be the case until probably she hangs up her racket. There's just never any selling her short, any counting her out. And she's going into a U.S. Open field that is still open. The women's side, I think, still is open, but Simona Halep really is getting to be a more and more reliable contender deep at these big tournaments.
Yeah.
She's won the number one ranking better than any other woman in a long time. She seems very comfortable with it, doesn't seem to mind the pressure, doesn't seem to mind the expectations of doing well, kind of rises to that occasion. Her self-belief's gotten way better, and she can draw on that in these tight matches, which she's done now twice in two big finals against Sloane Stephens this year, winning the French Open and winning a really good final last weekend in Montreal.
Yeah, we'll get to that week in Montreal. Also, we talked a little bit about Toronto. Obviously, we'll go back and look at that too. But for Simona Halep, do you just kind of paint that Wimbledon loss to Sue Ishe as just a hangover from the French Open win?
She had a match point. I mean, she wasn't playing bad, and Sue Ishe is one of the craziest players on tour. Just like what she does is so mad. She's a delight to watch if you're at the Open and find her on any outside court. I highly recommend checking out Sue Ishe. She has every shot in the book, and she'll use them and seemingly flip a random page and point to it and hit that. It's a lot of fun.
Yes.
It's bewildering, and she's pulled off a lot of big wins this year. I mean, she beat Muguruza in Australia. She almost beat Kerber in Australia this year with one of the better matches of the year. So, yeah, it's not a terrible loss, and the first major letdown, quote unquote, after winning your first major at the next major has been a standard issue thing in both men's and women's tennis recently. And Halep seems to be doing fine now, and I expect her to do pretty well in New York, where she doesn't have a lot to defend because she had that really tough draw last year playing Maria Sharapova first round. So I think she'll go into US Open hopefully in a pretty good mindset.
Yeah, let's stay there. Let's stay with the women. Montreal painted a better picture now for us in the US Open series. We're in Cincinnati. We've got New Haven before we head to the US Open. Yeah. Simona now has that big title under her belt, her third of the year after the French Open, and then wins in Montreal. But Sloane Stephens, you've got to feel like as the defending champion of the US Open, she'll also have a big spotlight on her, Ben. But it feels like when Sloane chooses to really engage, she is top five, reliable top three in the world.
No, that's where her ranking is. So, I mean, and you don't fluke those rankings. I mean, yeah. She got that top five ranking through being consistent. And one of the really impressive things about her ranking-wise is that even if she does lose first round of the U.S. Open, which I don't expect her to, but you never know, she's built enough of the ranking up rest of the year where it's not going to be a cataclysmic collapse in the rankings. She's not on the edge of a cliff like you sometimes feel, like a surprise slam champ. And she was, let's remember, a surprise winner there last year just by ranking. I mean, she was 900 earlier that summer, in the summer of 2017. So she's already done well she was defending a semifinal points actually in Canada, having made Rogers Cup semifinals last year, but now doing one better, making the final. That's got to take some pressure off. That's got to make her feel like, okay, I know how to do this. I'm already on a good path, already a little ahead of where I was this time last year. And she's become a really good competitor in this stage of her career. And I don't think people immediately recognize her as that all the time because she's so placid on court. Hmm. She's so often expressionless or so poker-faced and just so calm, which when it's going badly, people read as lack of effort or lack of, you know, intensity or passion. But with Sloane, clearly, when you watch what she does with the points, and there is a fire burning in there. She just keeps it pretty well covered.
Yeah. Okay, and if you can hear sort of a background noise, generally it's twilight here in Cincinnati. Crickets. So yeah, there's a lot of crickets hanging out. We also have Stan Wawrinka is on the grandstand court. Novak Djokovic just walked on to center court. Let's go ahead and transition to the men. Djokovic was a former champion in Canada, did not advance as far as he wanted to, actually knocked out by Stefanos Tsitsipas, who eventually made the final. But a couple headlines. You mentioned one, Rafael Nadal, who actually, I think, had to play his way into form a little bit in Canada. Had a good match against Stan Wawrinka. I think Wawrinka will take confidence out of that as he continues to come back from an injury. But what were a couple of the other bullet points? It feels as though the runner-up from last year, the Wimbledon runner-up, Kevin Anderson, continues to be a force deep in men's tournaments. And then we were, of course, missing Roger Federer and Andy Murray in Toronto.
No, definitely. I mean, there's a lot of different moving pieces, a lot of guys having, you know, results that we don't see, and a lot of guys playing lighter schedules than they used to, which also makes it tricky. Like, we haven't seen Roger since he lost Kevin Anderson, and he's obviously, you know, a very plausible pick to win the U.S. Open. You know, guys, even though he hasn't won it in 10 years, which is hard to believe, that he's in there always with the chance at these faster tournaments. If it's playing the way that he likes it, playing quick, he's never one to be counted out. But yeah, there's just less data on these guys for sure. Kevin skipped Washington, which he made the final of the last year before, and played pretty well against Tsitsipas. That was a very good match, that semifinal, actually. A lot of holds, but good tie breaks. It's tricky. It's tough to know exactly what's going on with the field. Djokovic posted a really, really good result at Wimbledon and made the final of Queen's Club. Pessimistically, you could say those are the only two good results he's had all year and not know exactly where he's going with it. We haven't seen him consolidate that per se, even though he has this enormous reputation, and it'd be easy to think that after winning Wimbledon everything will come right back to him, but it might not. We don't know with Djokovic. He's been spotty, and the loss to the Tsitsipas, I actually didn't see that match, but it looks not bad in the picture, but it was surprising when I saw the score. Like, oh, I wouldn't have thought that Wimbledon champion Novak Djokovic would come out and lose to a 19-year-old, even if Tsitsipas did back it up considerably and turn 20 by the weekend.
It was interesting, though, because coming into Queen's Club, Djokovic was 6-6 on the year.
Yeah.
That was into the French Open, makes the quarters, loses to Cecchinato, and then final at Queen's Club, wins Wimbledon, where he's a stretch of 21-3, but then, as you say, loses out to Tsitsipas. So it's interesting to read that barometer. Where is his game? Actually, I think Cincinnati will help us give, and this is the only Masters that he hasn't won, which is, I was reading about that today, 5-time runner-up.
It's incredible. I've called it with him. One of my tasks over the past few years is trying to come up with a name for what you would call it when somebody wins all of Masters titles, which no one's ever done. I prefer kind of becoming the Grandmaster.
I like that one.
For Novak personally, you can say he caught them all and became the Jokimon. which is a little more juvenile, and therefore I like that.
Perfect.
Yeah, so I mean, this has been an enigmatic tournament for him. There's a couple players like this who have tournaments like this. Djokovic in Cincinnati has made five finals. I think Rafa might have made five finals in Miami and never won it, which is another one he's missing in his Grandmaster quest. Sharapova, I think, has also made five finals in Miami and never won one. So there's a few players who have these ones where, like, it's not a bad tournament for Djokovic here. It would never be called that, but he's never won it. Compared to some other tournaments where maybe he has won, like, once and feels less comfortable. I'm trying to think what that would be for him. I mean, he's good everywhere, so it's kind of hard to come up with that example for him.
Yeah.
But, like, for Rafa, for example, Rafa is actually not great in Cincinnati historically, but he's better in Miami winning percentage-wise. He's just never won a title here, but he has won one in Cincinnati. So it's a weird anomalous thing. It'd be very cool to see him get that here or at some point. With how good the Big Four is, I'd like for one of them to get the all nine Masters quest completed.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that'd be pretty cool. And he's the one with the most realistic shot remaining, I think, to do it.
On Rafa, he did pull out of Cincinnati. We see Malik Jaziri's name replacing Rafa in the draw. Rafa's citing, I think, being pretty honest, just saying, I got the tennis in that I wanted and needed in Toronto. But were you a little bit surprised that he did pull out of Cincinnati?
No, I think it's smart. And I think that as much as it is tough, because I've gone to a lot of tournaments where there's a marquee player who pulls out, and it's frustrating as, you know, someone who's looking forward to covering this guy and seeing how they're doing, talking to him, because I wasn't in Canada. To talking to them there, especially these older guys, like, I've never once begrudged a Federer or a Nadal pulling out of these tournaments, because I know there's a plan behind it. It's not haphazard. It's not, oh, I'm just not in the mood. There is a bigger picture thinking behind it, and that's something I'm confident in with Rafa and Roger. And you know, it's a danger as a tournament director when you see someone go deep week before, especially coming to a slam, especially in Rafa's now 32. He doesn't need that many more matches. He's feeling comfortable on the hard courts. He can go to New York early and get comfortable there. Defending champion there, doesn't want to peak in Cincinnati or wear himself out in Cincinnati or aggravate some sort of pain or whatever.
Yep.
And so even if there is not like a tidy, I was curious what they put in the, I'm actually curious looking at this draw, what they put as a parenthetical reason for him pulling out.
It was cited as personal reasons.
It says fatigue on the draw now. So in the press release it said personal reasons, it was fatigue. I got some people telling me it was not, I tweeted it was personal reasons. People were like, it's not personal reasons. How can you say that about him? Like,
that's what the press release said.
Yeah, that's exactly what the press release said. And people were very upset at me for quoting it in quotation marks because he didn't say that. Like, oh, there's no convenient way to say selective scheduling, but or prudent scheduling. I would say prudence could go in the parentheses, but that might seem bad to the tournament if they don't want to feel prudent not to play. But, you know, players pick their spots. Serena pulled out of Canada, too.
Yeah.
And then it's here. Roger pulled out of Canada. I mean, it's tough. And I think as the game gets more physical and as these top stars get older every day, they have to be more and more selective and more smart. And I think Rafa hasn't gone the full Federer route of skipping an entire swing like the way Roger skips the clay court season, but he's picking and choosing more and more.
Mm.
And I can only, you know, salute that or nod and agree with that move. Yeah.
And historically, you know, this is the hard courts. Obviously, Rafa's won many of his titles on the hard courts, but clay is where he plays best. A few other names in the men's draw. Defending champion this week in Cincinnati is Grigor Dimitrov. Sasha Zverev had a title, won in Washington. Then he was also knocked out by Stefanos Tsitsipas. We're going to see how he's going to do this week. Marin Cilic is always a threat, the former U.S. Open champ, as is Juan Martín Del Potro. He pulled out with an injury, having made the final in Los Cabos.
Mm.
He pulls out of Toronto. He's back here in Cincinnati. We just have a couple minutes left with you, so let's go back to the women and just go ahead and look at, there's a lot of mechanisms at work. Simona Halep, we talked about Serena Williams. Would you put Serena in the conversation to win the title here? And then does it still feel, we were talking earlier in the season about how freaking open the women's draw is. French Open, it felt like we were naming 15 names, but do we walk into the U.S. Open feeling that as well, or have we whittled that list down a little bit?
I think you can make a short list from the long list, and don't throw out the long list because you might need it pretty soon, but you can make a shorter list. I mean, I think that Kerber has solidified herself as a very solid player all year. I mean, she did lose first round of Canada, so, you know, that happens, but she's been very consistent. Simona Halep is in that list, obviously, playing very well. Sloane is there, defending champion, looking in good shape. And then Serena, and I think you could almost end the list of the short list at those four. Would I take those four against the field? Maybe, which is more than I would normally say in women's tennis in the last several years. It really has been open. I mean, since Serena left the tour, I guess, with her pregnancy, it really has felt wide open. And there could be room for surprises, but especially at Wimbledon, we didn't have any of the top 10 seeds make it to the quarterfinals even. Only one made the fourth round. So it won't be that extreme, I don't think.
No.
I'd be very surprised by that. U.S. Open is a tournament that doesn't tend to have draws really surprised. I mean, it does. I mean, Avinci made a final, and, you know, Sloane was the surprise winner.
Sure.
But in general, no. And Panetta did win. Now I'm talking myself out of that thought. But yeah, I don't think expect a shock. I think it's going to be someone who has been building up to this, and that would include Serena this year.
You mentioned those four players, but then you also have someone like, or a list like, Caroline Wozniacki, Alina Svitolina, Petra Kvitova, Madison Keys, Garbiñe Muguruza.
All plausible.
All plausible.
All plausible. Madison Keys, yeah, all those players could do it. You can throw in someone even like a Pliskova could get it together in the next 2 weeks and make a deep run. She made the final just 2 years ago in New York, and she was number one this time last year. People forget that. So, I mean, there's a lot of space for people. Coco Vandeweghe is coming back from injury. She made semifinals there. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that might be a reach, but there's a lot of, you know, people out there who have very plausible cases for themselves, and that's what makes women's tennis so exciting and so unknowable so much of the time.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you very much, Ben Rothenberg.
Thank you, Nick.
Thanks indeed to Ben for joining us. You can follow Ben on Twitter at Ben Rothenberg, where he's one of the most prolific tweeters in the tennis biz. With the U.S. Open so close, go to usopen.org for all your U.S. Open ticket needs and everything U.S. Open. Tickets, TV times, draws, orders of play, previews, wrap-ups, everything you need. It's all there on usopen.org. Now let's get to our featured conversation with Kyle Edmund. He's currently ranked a career-high number 16 in the world, and if you're listening to this before Tuesday evening, he's set to play against Canadian young gun Denis Shapovalov in Cincinnati in what's sure to be a must-see match. Earlier this season, he made the Australian Open semifinals in a breakout run with victories over Kevin Anderson and Grigor Dimitrov. Since then, he's made the quarterfinals at the Masters 1000 event in Madrid. He finished runner-up in Marrakesh, Morocco, and he also made the third round at Wimbledon, where he lost to eventual champ Novak Djokovic. This is a couple weeks ago, but here's my chat with Kyle Edmund. Kyle, coming into the U.S. Open series, obviously a lot of attention on you at Wimbledon, but how do you rate your game on the hard courts? You've had some great success, including the Australian Open semis earlier this year.
Yeah, the hard courts is something, you know, is a bit more, I guess, easier to transition on for myself, because I played more time on there than the grass, but I've had good results, you know, over the past 2 years. You know, the US Open, I reached fourth round a couple of years ago and the third round last year, so I've won some matches there. But yeah, it's always, I guess, an exciting time to come to America anyway. I like it here and the courts, but this stretch is a really nice stretch with the, you know, this tournament, two must series in the Grand Slam. You know, everyone gets really well looked after. The standing's good. And when you can get on a bit of a run at these sort of, you say, tour or stretch of tournaments, it always helps you.
Okay, there was obviously a lot of attention in that run at the Australian Open semifinals, but you mentioned it a couple years ago, you made the fourth round at the US Open. Did that feel like, at that time, a breakthrough run? You beat Gasquet in the first round and then took out Isner in four sets in the third round before going out to Djokovic.
Yeah, the fourth round US was probably like my first, you say, maybe like big tournament, like I did well, or a breakthrough or something. So, you know, that was a big one for me at the time, still is. So yeah, to beat Gasquet first round, and then you know, like John, great player on the hard court, the American number one, and so on. So at the time, it was really great. And before that, even juniors, I reached the semis of the boys, won the doubles there. So always liked playing there, and I think it's shown in sort of the senior event that I like playing there, the conditions. So yeah, it's always sort of good to look forward to go there, and hopefully you don't take it for granted, because you always have to earn your right and win the matches. But it's always you know, like a good way to play the last slam of the year and get that sort of last big opportunity.
Yeah, Kyle, you're a pretty soft-spoken, quiet guy, but it seems like the U.S. Open somehow speaks to you. Is it conditions? Are you like, do you like the atmosphere too? Because it's a pretty boisterous tournament in and of itself.
The conditions are good. I really like them. It's always, obviously, it sometimes can rain, but the conditions are always pretty hot and lively. The ball really gets up on those courts. Yeah. That's what I like about it, and it rewards good play, like attacking play. So it's tough to sort of turn defense into attack if someone's really attacking you, and that's my game. So I like the way it plays in that sense. But as you say, the atmosphere is always, it's probably the loudest slam. Just it's the way people are in New York. They like to get stuck in and get involved. So no, it's always good to have that sort of atmosphere. And of course, when you play in American, they're there to support Americans. But for myself, I get support there either way, but there's also quite a lot of British, surprisingly, there that are supporting.
I know that you players try not to pay attention to what we in the media are talking about all the time. Wimbledon, you were the British number one, made the third round, played a nice match against Novak Djokovic. How was just that experience for you overall, Kyle, going home, playing in front of the home crowd and having that number one British pressure on your shoulders?
It was a great experience. I mean, my sort of best experience at Wimbledon so far in my career. It was, yeah, I mean, it's been the biggest build-up I've had to a tournament by far. You know, I guess that expectation from myself and other people around, just more off-court commitments, responses, media, whatever it is, appearances. So that adds to everything, you know, mentally and stuff and physically. So that was a new experience for me. In terms of tennis, I think I played... I think my best I have on the grass courts this year. I sort of did my job in terms of winning my first two rounds that I was expected to win, and then when you come up against Novak, who won the tournament, for goodness sake. So
yeah, exactly.
It was a tough one. So I think I did almost what everyone, I guess, expected me to do. But for myself personally, it was good to have that match with Novak. Of course, I lost, but you can see the guy was playing well, and also for me to play on the centre court against him was another experience that you bank.
You've had obviously a great year, Kyle, making the semis in Australia, having a great run in Madrid as well. Inside the top 20 now, does it feel like expectations or pressure has changed, or for you is it just trying to stay the course day in and day out?
The sort of like... I think after the beginning of the year in terms of Australia, things changed.
Yeah.
Just naturally through ranking and personal expectation and so on. That comes with, you know, any sort of sport, I guess you go up through the rankings. But that mentality I've had since the start of the year, I've sort of carried on throughout this year. Like, you're always wanting to make that next step, stay inside the 20 and keep improving. Obviously, a goal of mine is to get my first tour event. That would be great. I'm still obviously... looking for that. Got to one final now, so that's definitely a goal of mine that will be there until I do get it. So there's all these little goals you have, but I think overall it's like a good healthy position to have these sort of thoughts and problems to have, you could say.
You've got one of the most well-spoken, I think, and introspective coaches on tour, Freddie Rosengren, who's never short on life advice for any of us. But what do you feel like he's brought to your game? He's obviously done a great job with you, and he's a jovial character to watch on tour.
Yeah, he's definitely a good character. He's been really great to work with. Of course, his experience he's had over the years is great to be able to... almost what you say, you know, get feedback from and information, and you know, he's been on tour for so long, you can argue he's forgotten more than I know, you know, that sort of way to look at it. So he's got heaps of experience and knowledge that has been great to get, tactical, technical, whatever it is, mental, on and off the court. So it's just helped me grow as a player on court and as a person, you know, off the court, learning stuff. And that's also with Mark Hilton joined in. He's obviously taught me stuff, and Fidia and Mark work together, and we try and put importance on that. I'm getting the same information rather than two different sets of information. So I think it's been really good. It's been relaxed, but getting the points across when we need them at the right time. So overall, I'm happy with how things have gone, and I guess it's sort of shown in my results all the way, but this year's gone, you could say.
Okay, I learned during Wimbledon that most people in Britain call you Ketters. Is any Kyle Ketters, or where does Ketters come from?
I think
help us Americans understand this.
So I think it first started, obviously I'm Edmund, and then you took the K. Yeah. So it first started with Kedmund as the K and the Edmund joined together, but then Kedmund, and then it over time just became Kedders. That's my sort of view on it. People's might be different, but I think that's sort of where it sort of came from.
And essentially anyone on tour would just call you Ketters?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, maybe people that don't know me as well, but a lot of people call me Ketters now, yeah.
Yeah. We do have Andy Murray back on tour. I know that he's been a good voice in your ear for a long time, but for him, as far as coming back to tennis, it's a tough road to hoe. How have you sort of experienced what he's gone through separately as a friend and as a player?
Yeah, it's been very tough with him. Something that is tough to answer because I don't know what it's like to almost take a year out of the game. So yeah, it is tough. I can imagine mentally it's frustrating when you want to get back, but you just got to be patient. So I haven't asked him so much about that, but before that, in terms of what he brought to me as a player, learning from him, improving, being able to train with him, see him at Davis Cup and so on, so all those things really help. And of course you ask him stuff, and then most of my learning has come from just watching him and observing through the eye. So yeah, that's the best way I've learned from him. And you know, he's pretty much going to go down as one of the best players of all time and the best player in British history, so you couldn't have asked like a better person to get advice from.
Okay, Kyle, lastly, favorite thing about being in New York City? I know that you enjoy obviously playing at the National Tennis Center, but you enjoy being in Manhattan too?
Yeah, I love New York. I always have done. I really like the buzz of it, of course. It's crazy. Just so busy. It's actually one of them where I say to the guys, I'm always pumped to go there, but actually when I leave I'm not too sad, just because it can get so busy, and obviously playing tennis tournaments, so it can be quite busy anyway with the tennis. So it's great to be there. Also we go once every year, so there's always time to look forward to it. And I've been going there since I was a junior, now the seniors, and always sort of had a good time there, so hopefully this year's the same.
Yeah, all right, well, we wish you best of luck.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks again to Kyle for that discussion. And if you want to see Kyle and all the other big stars of the Pro Tennis Tour at the US Open, don't forget to head to Ticketmaster to secure your US Open tickets. Ticketmaster is the only official ticketing partner of the US Open. A big thanks to Ben Rothenberg as well as Kyle Edmund for joining us on episode 20 of Courtside, the official podcast of the US Open. We're double dipping again this week. Steve Flink returns on Thursday as his Rolodex continues to deliver. It's five-time U.S. Open champion Pete Sampras in a rare interview you won't want to miss. I'm Nick McCarville, and I want to thank you for listening. You can find Courtside on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and more. And if you've missed any of our previous 19 episodes, they're all archived for you to go back and listen and enjoy. We're going to be back next week with more as the U.S. Open ticks closer and closer. But for now, goodbye.